You've heard about spear phishing emails and so-called business email compromise attacks, but do you know how to spot them if they're targeting your organization? If not, you might want to tune in on February 7th at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time for a Security Ledger webinar sponsored by Greathorn. We're going to be talking about how modern email-based attacks can be stopped with a full lifecycle approach to security that combines perimeter-based detection with user awareness and robust incident response and remediation. To register, go to securityledger.com/email. That's E-M-A-I-L. securityledger.com/email to register. This is the Security Ledger Podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, Editor-in-Chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode number 131, as the U.S. pursues criminal charges against China's largest technology firm, Huawei Technologies, for corporate espionage, we're looking in our second segment at one of the federal government's most potent tools to stop the transfer of sensitive intellectual property, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., or CFIUS. But first, U.S. District Court Judge Lucy Koh slapped down a proposed settlement of a class action lawsuit filed against Yahoo this week. The suit stems from a 2013 hack of the company that exposed data on some 3 billion users. It's just the latest twist in the legal saga at the once great search giant, who fell victim to hackers and then astoundingly conspired to keep the breach a secret for years. But another Yahoo lawsuit that was quietly settled late last year may have far bigger long-term consequences for private sector firms and their executives. That was the settlement of a so-called derivative lawsuit filed on behalf of Yahoo shareholders against the company's executives. We invited Craig Newman, the head of the data privacy practice at the New York law firm of Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, into the Security Ledger studios to talk about the derivative lawsuit and why it's so unusual. To start, I asked Craig to explain for our listeners what a derivative lawsuit is.
Craig Newman. I'm a partner with Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, and I chair our data security group. A derivative lawsuit, it's a unique legal mechanism. It's not like you read about class action lawsuits filed all the time about companies. A derivative lawsuit is a little bit different. It's where shareholders actually stand in the shoes of the company, and they file a lawsuit based on what the shareholders perceive as a wrong that's done by the company. So it's really an action by shareholders against the company, but they're not suing really in their own name, but they're suing on behalf of the company to get the board or senior executives to take certain action. And when there is a recovery, if there's, you know, money damages, things like that, other than attorney's fees, that money normally goes back into the company. So it's a rather unique legal mechanism and not all that common.
In this case, I mean, one thing worth pointing out is that the as a result of the derivative suit, it's the folks suing, the plaintiffs, are not actually expecting to collect any money themselves. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. I mean, the way these normally shake out, and as you point out, Yahoo is definitely the exception. The way these normally shake out, the derivative lawsuits, is that the derivative suits will be filed. The preponderance of the cases are settled, and the settlements are usually a combination of two things. One, there'll be an attorney fee component, so the plaintiff's lawyers who have prosecuted the case, they'll get usually, at least in data breach cases, they'll get a modest attorney fee award. And then there'll be some what we call governance changes. So, for example, you know, part of the Yahoo settlement, and this is also true in other data breach derivative cases, the settlements will also include a series of cyber hygiene changes, changes to the data security environment, better firewalls, things that will help the company up their cybersecurity game. So it's really a combination of attorney's fees on the one hand and governance and data security changes on the other. So those are usually the two components of a derivative settlement. But as you note, the Yahoo settlement is unique in that there is actually a third component, and that was a chunk of money is actually being allocated to go back into the company, which is highly unusual, especially in a data breach case.
As you point out in your deal book, these tend to be very hard cases for plaintiffs to win on these derivative suits against executives. Why is that?
Because what you're really focused on is many derivative lawsuits name members of boards of directors as defendants. Those are the people being sued in many of these cases. And as a director for a public company, my job is not to run the day-to-day operations of the company. I have what's called oversight responsibility. And that means I oversee a lot of the risks of the company. But as a board member, it's not my responsibility to engage in day-to-day activities. I oversee things. I make sure things are being done properly. The best analogy I can give you is that corporate directors, they put their nose under the tent, but they try to keep their fingers outside of the tent. So right. It is a true oversight responsibility. They're there to ask the tough questions and make sure that they get good answers to those questions, but they're not in charge of the day-to-day operations of the company. That's management's job. As a matter of policy, the SEC and basic tenets of corporate governance, you want to encourage high-integrity, smart people to serve on public company boards. You don't want to have any sort of disincentive for really qualified people to be on boards. So what the law has done is recognize something called the business judgment rule. And that means that so long as a director, an officer, they're making decisions that are well-informed and in good faith, it's unlikely they would ever be held responsible for some sort of a ball drop. So as long as they're doing their jobs, they're doing it in good faith, and they're well-informed, they get the benefit of what's called the business judgment rule. And it's an awfully difficult hurdle for a shareholder or a plaintiff to get over that hurdle.
Right. Except when you have really egregious, horrible incidents like the Yahoo data breach. And as you point out in your deal book article in the New York Times, it's been unusual to have these derivative cases, succeed. And this is basically the first that you know of, or it's really unusual to see these filed in the context of a cyber incident. Talk about, just briefly, what exposure executives have had to cyber-related litigation up to now, and also why this Yahoo case is such an outlier and resulted in this successful derivative lawsuit.
So you're absolutely right. The vast majority of these derivative lawsuits are dismissed, and you'd never see them again. What makes the Yahoo case unique is the plaintiffs, the shareholders, filed a 119-page complaint. And in lawyer land, that's a really, really long complaint. And a lot of it was heavily redacted, which means certain portions of the complaint were taken out of the public record. So even when I was reviewing the complaint, I don't have a full picture of what some of the allegations that were made. But I will tell you, having reviewed the complaint several times, and again, these are allegations, they're not proven, they're what the shareholders think happened, but there are some pretty nefarious allegations made against senior executives at Yahoo. And that is probably what has driven this sort of a settlement, because you normally don't see allegations that go all the way to the top and that transpired over a number of years, and that things were hidden, they were covered up. And those are some of the allegations in the complaint, and those are pretty serious allegations. Sitting here today, we don't know if they're true or not, and now that it's settled, it's unlikely we'll ever know. But the fact that there was an allocation of money actually going back to the company suggests, to me at least, that the insurance companies were concerned enough with the allegations that they thought the case was better settled than litigated.
Can I break in with a question? When you say that the complaint was redacted, I mean, I'm used to thinking about redactions in the context of, classified or sensitive material. Who gets to decide that information in a public lawsuit gets to be redacted and kept from the public?
Great question, because there is, as you're suggesting, there is a presumption, especially in our country, of total openness in our judicial system. So it is highly irregular for, you know, absent concerns about national security, it's highly irregular to have a redacted complaint unless you're dealing with things like, you know, patents, trade secrets, things like that, where there's justifiable reasons to keep that stuff private. But here, I assume got leave of court or permission of the court to redact it because it was probably some very highly sensitive proprietary information that may have gone to some of the technology that Yahoo used for its cyber defenses. And if that's true, you certainly can understand that no one would want to put that sort of information in the hands of the bad guys.
Okay, so that would have been a request that Yahoo and its attorneys made to the judge, and the judge would have been amenable to keeping that information out of the public. But of course, because it's redacted, we actually don't know what material is behind those redactions. You're saying you've read it, and it could be technical information. We don't know.
Right, and it, as you point out, it's a high bar to convince a judge to allow parties to redact information because there is a presumption of complete openness and transparency in our court system. So they must have made a pretty strong case that whatever was redacted was highly sensitive and could do real harm to Yahoo if it was publicly disclosed.
Okay. And just to be clear, I mean, the defendants in this case are really the executive, the C-suite, and also the board, or is it just the C-suite? I know Marissa Mayer is named, Kenneth Goldman, Ronald Bell, top executives of the company, and others as well.
Right. So the folks who were sued include, as you point out, not just former top executives, but also former board members of the company. So it's really the executive leadership team and some of the board of directors, which is fairly common in a derivative suit because those are the folks charged with oversight responsibility.
In the end, this suit, as you say, it alleges really, I guess what you could call a vast conspiracy to keep secret a very large, very consequential breach of Yahoo's security. It resulted in the theft of information on hundreds of millions of Yahoo users. Basically, a conspiracy to keep that knowledge of that secret from the markets, from Yahoo's shareholders, as well as from the authorities for upwards of 2 years.
Right. I mean, if you believe the allegations in the complaint, and that's a big if because none of us have the ability at this point to really test whether or not those are true. But the complaint says all of this started in 2013 and continued until 2016. That's a pretty long period of time, and there were no public disclosures made during that period about the data breach. And having handled a ton of these breaches, periods of 3-4 years is an enormous amount of time for a breach to go on and be investigated. But according to the complaint, at least, a number of different breaches were involved. So it looks like it was somewhat of an evolving situation. But you are totally right that this durational, at least, took a lot longer than kind of the typical breach we see in the headlines, every week.
What do you think the motivation of the plaintiffs was in settling this, given that, again, they aren't going to get any money themselves, and the amount of money going back to Yahoo and its shareholders in this case was quite small. I mean, it was a $29 million settlement. The lawyers took $11 million, so you got $18 million. I mean, that's certainly not of consequence to a company the size of Yahoo, let alone Verizon that now owns Yahoo. So why settle if what you really want is to expose the malfeasance?
Because these are really tough cases to win. And again, in order to successfully state a claim against a corporate officer or director, you have to get over what we talked about earlier, which is the business judgment rule. It's a pretty high climb. But the fact that they were able to get about $18 million to go back to the company, that is really an eye-opener because in data breach settlements, this is the first time, at least I'm aware, of a derivative case where the shareholders have actually gotten a chunk of cash. And obviously, people saw enough risk in this case that they settled it for more than just attorney's fees and governance changes. And that's the big takeaway from this.
Okay, so that brings us to the next topic, which is what are the implications of the, given that they actually got something like a win here by in the form of a settlement and a payment, what are the implications out there for other companies that have been or might be the victims of cyber incidents like this, data breaches, and so forth? Up until now, there have mostly been kind of slaps on the wrist in the form of penalties, whether that's, you know, HIPAA or PCI, not much that have gone to or touched the, you know, the C-suite. So what are the implications of this going forward, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you also have to just put a little context around your question. You know, Yahoo also got slapped by the SEC for $35 million.
Right.
Because of a late disclosure on the breach. You know, again, $35 million in the context of a company like Yahoo, is it a lot of money? No, it's not a lot of money. But it's the first cyber disclosure case ever brought by the SEC. So that sent another very loud message. And the second thing to think about is, this is one of the cases where you actually have, you can calculate the damage that it did, because remember, this whole breach came out in the context of an M&A transaction when Yahoo was selling its core internet operations to Verizon. And Verizon ended up getting a, you know, fairly significant discount. I believe it was about a $350 million discount on a $4.5 billion deal. So you really have, you know, a couple of facts there that you hardly see in other cases. It's, you know, the SEC has been very vocal about this. They were not happy with the late disclosures. You have damages that you can actually calculate, because you have what I would call a hack discount. And that all came out during the M&A transaction.
$350 million, yep.
And the third thing I would say is, for corporate America, this should serve, at least I hope it serves, as somewhat of a wake-up call, because this is the first time where officers and directors, you know, they have to take a seat back and say, you know what? This is a derivative case where the insurance, and remember, all of this money came out of the insurance carrier's pocket. This was not out of the treasury of Yahoo. So you have some really sophisticated insurance carriers in a room negotiating this, and they obviously saw enough risk in the case, or at least enough risk in proceeding with the case, to write that check for an extra $18 million, which might seem insignificant to you, but having sat through a lot of those negotiations, that's not insignificant to an insurance company. That was the product of a lot of negotiation and a lot of thought.
What is going on in the mind of an organization that suffers a data breach and then is confronted with the need to disclose it in some way versus the desire to sweep it under the rug?
That, first of all, is a great question, and it's really the dilemma any company faces, because in the early hours of a data breach, you don't know all that much information. You don't know, is this significant? Is this serious? Is it material? What kind of information is potentially being compromised? So there's a learning curve you have to get up to before you can even make the decision as to whether it becomes a disclosable event. And if you're a public company and the data breach is material, and, you know, there is a kind of a legal test people use, you know, would the ordinary investor want to know this information? It's an evolving circumstance. At the end of the day, it's really a judgment call on what to disclose and when to disclose. But as you can tell from the Yahoo SEC settlement, you have to be very cautious, because you don't want to say too much, because you don't know all that much at the beginning of a breach. But on the other hand, you want to be as transparent as possible and let your investors know what's going on. So it's always a balancing act. And you just try to be as transparent as possible and not get too far over your skis when you're making these sorts of disclosures.
Are we ever going to find out the details of what really happened inside Yahoo between 2013 and 2016? Are we ever going to know the full story?
Probably not. Having gone through this complaint a number of times and probably read everything that's been out there on it, you know, cases settle for reasons. You know, it may be more expedient. It may be a balancing of it's going to cost us X to litigate, so it's just less expensive and in the shareholders' best interest to settle the case. So you just don't know the dynamics that go on behind closed doors during these settlements. But you look at the allegations, and they're pretty serious. But will we ever know if they're 100% truthful? We won't.
Craig Newman of Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Up next, U.S. prosecutors at the Department of Justice filed criminal charges against Huawei Technologies, China's largest technology company. The suit alleges that Huawei stole trade secrets from an American rival and committed bank fraud by violating sanctions against doing business with Iran. The move is just the latest in a series of actions that the Trump administration has taken to curb the influence of foreign technology firms who are deemed a threat to U.S. security. But one of the government's most potent tools against foreign-owned firms is CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., an obscure intra-agency group that assesses the national security implications of investments by foreigners in U.S. businesses. Cybersecurity has long been an area of interest for CFIUS, but as cybersecurity moves to the center of U.S. foreign policy, the reach of CFIUS reviews has expanded. How is the evolution of cyber risk affecting CFIUS reviews? To talk about that, we invited Luke Tenery, the Senior Managing Director and Head of the Cybersecurity Practice at the firm Ancora. Luke came into the Security Ledger studios, and to start off, I asked him to explain what the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. does.
Luke Tenery, Senior Managing Director at Ancora Consulting Group.
Luke, welcome to the Security Ledger podcast.
Thanks for having me.
First order of business is probably tell us a little bit about Ancora if our listeners are not familiar with your company, and they likely aren't. What do you guys do?
Sure, Paul. Ancora Consulting is a business advisory services firm. We really span the globe and serve our clients in a variety of ways. We like to think that kind of one of our lines is collaboration drives results, and that's certainly what you can expect from our firm. In my unit that I co-lead in the cybersecurity practice, it's not unusual at all for us to integrate across practice lines to serve our clients in creative ways, but namely, I focus in the area of cybersecurity. Much of our work is incident response related, as well as investigative in nature. We also assist firms in a variety of more proactive or risk management based cybersecurity services as well. And actually, we have some perspective on that hopefully, at least from a compliance perspective, and CFIUS, we hope to cover with you today.
We ran into each other at a insurance and cybersecurity conference out on the West Coast in Santa Monica. It was focused on issues related to cyber risk in the insurance industry. And kind of as we were comparing notes, one of the interesting topics that came up was around CFIUS, a Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., and how CFIUS reviews are becoming more common for technology acquisitions. I guess maybe a good place to start, Luke, would be to just remind our audience, if they're not already familiar with this, which they may not be, what is CFIUS and what is its purview? Like, what does this committee typically take interest in?
Sure, Paul. Great question. CFIUS is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. It is an interagency committee that considers, in essence, the national security risks of foreign transactions or foreign direct investment in the United States. It actually dates back to the 70s. I think actually General Ford executed an executive order in 75. It's been updated through the years. But ultimately, it's the U.S. government's mechanism or one of their primary sort of compliance and enforcement mechanisms to monitor foreign investment in U.S.-based companies for national security considerations.
And what types of companies generally has this Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. taken an interest in?
It's really interesting. There, you know, how we view it, you know, most recently, there's definitely some interesting trends. You know, there's been some recent cases that have highlighted the types of areas of concern. Critical technologies and critical infrastructure have been really important. One that we're seeing a lot of as well is personal data, the personal information of U.S. citizens or even government employees. So kind of think the MoneyGram transaction by Ant Financial. I believe that was in 2017. There were also aspects of that, too, with possible access to financial market information. And then some of the older ones that are throwback, but still relevant, perhaps proximity to government facilities or considerations there that just out of close proximity. But generally, technology, personal information, financially related or physical proximity, but ultimately a pretty broad mix. And many of those are actually, you know, obviously there's concerns on how those are related from a cybersecurity perspective at times.
So in the information security space, no stranger to this, famously an acquisition of the firm SourceFire by the Israeli firm Checkpoint fell afoul of a CFIUS review. I think that was back in 2006 or 2007 that happened. Is cybersecurity one of those areas where, again, regulators in the form of this Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. might look askance at security companies being subsumed into large foreign firms, especially like those from China that might have links back to the government or the military?
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts on that, Paul. I think at, you know, one level, it's clear that they're interested in protecting critical technology. Someone could certainly state that about different security technology that, you know, is heavily relied upon by some of our most valuable companies, government entities, et cetera. People often forget that, you know, the government often buys some of the same security technology to as our corporate. So you can just sort of imagine, particularly as noted just recently with some of the news around the supply chain attacks that have affected potentially Apple and some of the possible motherboard issues there. So I think there's a couple issues there at play. I mean, one is, you know, we are relying upon these technologies that drive the security of our nation and or, you know, the security of the companies that, you know, underpin quite a bit of our GDP. And also, I think it highlights another issue in even more globally and at a macro level, beyond just CFIUS, the government is interested in, you know, aspects of supply chain security. Even in 2017, the president issued an executive order limiting the government's use of Kaspersky software or eradicating it altogether. So I think there's a number of issues there. Software and broader hardware security is certainly an aspect. And we know that one of the larger kind of semiconductor transactions was blocked as well. And so I think there will be, you know, some level of persistency to, you know, the government's concern around critical technologies, but also, you know, critical technologies that bring, you know, greater assurances to just the overall security of our organizations and our government.
You mentioned a couple things that companies need to be thoughtful about if they're approached by a foreign investor. One was, you know, the data they possess. Obviously, the intellectual property they possess. What are some other things that, again, generally is going to get the interest of regulators? I mean, under these new rules, and I guess maybe even under the old rules, companies are required to contact or notify the government within 45 days of the completion of a transaction, I think, by a foreign investor. So you have to disclose these things. But what are some things that might give the government regulators pause as they look at your company and the potential of this investment or acquisition by a foreign buyer?
Yeah, I think that's the $10,000 question. You know, part of the aspect of this is, you know, only the government can sort of define what amounts to a national security risk. So, you know, there's obviously, you know, some element of the unknown and security that right. only they can sort of know and enforce. Clearly, how we looked at it earlier and, you know, what we're seeing that is of utmost concern, we're seeing elements of personal information, of chief concern, and then again, you know, aspects of the technology side. And I think generally, though, if organizations have some level of awareness on those things and, you know, you're working with highly experienced third parties or counsel, there's generally some level of dialogue that goes into, especially if an organization is being proactive with, you know, that process to, you know, ensure that there's some level of understanding as far as where the elements of concern might be.
Should companies be fearful that, you know, deals, investments, acquisitions by foreign buyers are just going to be ruled out kind of out of hand, you know, particularly if, let's say, a Chinese company is on the other end of the transaction? Or do most of these deals ultimately get the nod, maybe with some revisions or some small tweaks to make CFIUS happy?
Dynamic question there. I think at some level, you know,
this is a dynamic podcast, Luke.
Yeah, it certainly is. You're keeping me on my toes, Paul. But from my perspective, I think there's reason for optimism. You know, I've read recently with multiple sources kind of showing the, you know, between 2011 and 2016, I believe it was, the Government Accountability Office noted that there's been a 55% increase in CFIUS reviews between 2011 and 2016. You know, at some level, I think that could be deceiving. We know at some level, whether it's, you know, foreign investment or domestic, that, you know, companies being acquired are actually a sign of a healthy economy. And so I think there's reason for optimism, though, across the board. But I do think, though, that, you know, given some of the sophistication of our adversaries as a nation, as well as just the broader cybersecurity posture enhancements by our government, even at a higher macro level, there's likely to be some consideration in that, but I don't think it's an element of fear. I think it's just, you know, enhanced process that, you know, ultimately is somewhat related to just the health of, you know, economies.
Luke Tenery of Ancora, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast. It's been great to have you on.
Thanks, Paul. Pleasure being here, and I just appreciate the opportunity.